people want you gone. You are the primary suspect in what happened on October 7. You blame others and even lie persistently when you accuse the head of the Shin Bet, who achieved remarkable successes, of being a spy. Oren Helman, does Ben Gavir really represent who the people of Israel want to control the police? Is this really someone the people of Israel believe should be allowed to attack the head of the Shin Bet? Is this person who has the right to say that the head of the Shin Bet should be put in a prison cell? Do you understand what will happen to our country because of this administration?
What's your opinion on these divided reactions, Dr. Omar, as it's obvious, concerning the dismissal of Ronen Bar?
Yeah, I believe there are these differences and these divisions within the Israeli entity's population. However, I think these are not very serious divisions. You know, the Israelis, they all agree, I think, deep inside, that they need to get rid of the Palestinians. What does it, getting rid of the Palestinians mean? It means genocide, extermination.
The majority, Dr. Omar?
All of them. I would say you cannot live in an entity that that encourages and performs a genocide. You cannot do that. If you remain there, even if you express yourself like the way they're having these divisions, these are just, disagreements, general disagreements. There haven't been any serious clashes within the Israeli community itself. We're waiting for that, though.
Dr. Omar Nashabi, political analyst, thank you for joining us. It's always nice having you on our show.
Thank you.
Time is up. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Suppression of dissent in the United States of America is not a new phenomenon. Western regimes will increasingly resort to crude tactics of the type implemented by dictatorships they support abroad, blatantly suppressing dissenting voices. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, the arrest of Mahmoud Khalil, a Palestinian graduate of Columbia University who played a prominent role in anti-genocide protests against Israel, has reignited discussions about the so-called freedom of speech in America. This debate is further amplified by Donald Trump's political adversaries, many of whom had supported the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, along with draconian measures against Muslims, both in the U.S. and abroad. Suppression of dissent in the United States of America is not a new phenomenon. In June 2022, Crescent International had predicted that, as the West-centric global order unravels, Western regimes will increasingly resort to crude tactics of the type implemented by dictatorships they support abroad, blatantly suppressing dissenting voices. The primary distinction is that Trump's regime, due to its overt ignorance, lacks the cunning and subtlety of the Obama regime in executing such repression. one particularly telling case that has been largely forgotten by today's self-proclaimed free speech crusaders is that of Tariq Mehna, arrested in October 2009 under dubious circumstances. His case exemplifies the misuse of legal mechanisms to stifle political opposition. An extensive analysis of Mehna's case in the Christian Science Monitor highlighted this stark reality. Quote, a young Muslim male who believed he had the right to express his deep disdain for American foreign policy in the Middle East and Asia. Tariq Mehna, an American-born Bostonian, took his First Amendment rights quite seriously when he vocally condemned his government for killing thousands of Muslims abroad. As a result, he was convicted of conspiring to help Al-Qaeda, unquote. Detractors might argue that Mehna was convicted for being a member of Al-Qaeda. History, however, shows that no regime openly admits to arresting individuals for speaking truth to power. Instead, legal formalities are manipulated to camouflage politically motivated repression. A phrase often attributed to Stalin captures this strategy well, quote, show me the man and I will show you the crime, unquote. While freedom of thought and speech is indeed more protected in the United States than in regions where Western-backed regimes enforce brutal repression, such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, or the UAE, this freedom only extends so far as it does not expose the crimes of the ruling elite. The moment dissenting voices begin to influence political outcomes, the cost of speech becomes evident. As it becomes increasingly clear that Western powers, particularly the U.S., are being relegated to mid-level status in global affairs, their reaction to alternative viewpoints is only set to become more aggressive. The United States, as the principal hegemon of the Western world, has the most to lose from this shift and is therefore likely to lead the charge in brutal crackdowns on dissent. Two major factors will exacerbate political and social turmoil in the U.S. as Washington's tolerance for alternative views continues to erode: Zionism and the inherent idealism of ordinary Americans. The Zionist lobby now fully understands that a growing number of Americans perceive its influence over U.S. politics as a direct threat to their sovereignty. Recognizing that they are becoming increasingly cornered, Zionist interest groups have chosen to double down on their efforts to suppress critics, an approach clearly evident in the case of Mahmoud Khalil. However, this strategy has led to a paradoxical situation. Regardless of one's view of American society, it remains fundamentally idealistic. This deeply ingrained idealism will inevitably generate a strong backlash against Zionist attempts to weaponize laws against influential political activists and outspoken critics. Ironically, the Zionist greatest adversary may be none other than Donald Trump and his circle of loyalists. Through their crude and heavy-handed critics, they may inadvertently serve as catalysts for mobilizing the American people against Zionist influence in the United States of America. Given Israel's excessive dependence on U.S. backing, a significant shift in American public sentiment poses an existential threat to the Zionist project. The unraveling of the Western order is not a passive process, but an active battleground. No repressive empire is dismantled without cost and sacrifice. Washington's response to America's imperial decline will determine whether the United States can adapt to a multipolar world with some degree of stability or descend into a state of decline, reminiscent of the Soviet Union in late 1980s.
Children are victims of a war that ended over a half a century ago. Landmines and explosive remnants of war are the cursed inheritance left to them by war. Munitions were left in this war zone and have been buried over time. Some failed to explode after firing, and some were prepared to be fired, but were left behind when the forces had to advance or retreat in a hurry. Their sensitivity has changed over time, and the original standards can't be relied on during the clearance process. These types of ordnance can be moved around with every flood. The composition of the soil in some parts of Khuzestan province is such that surface runoff water doesn't seep into the ground very easily. This means that some contaminated areas become inaccessible due to flooding. The area of the contaminated region changes with the rise and fall of water levels. These regions cannot be used under any circumstances and even pose a threat to safe zones nearby. Until recently, this region was underwater, and the demining squad has only just been able to access it. Another difficulty of the demining process is the effect that time and changes in climate have on the landmines and ordnance. They might not be triggerable anymore, or they might have become more sensitive. An anti-tank mine might have become as sensitive as an anti-personnel mine. Any problem becomes more difficult to solve when a clear assessment of the matter can't be made. In the case of landmines and unexploded munitions, these changes are literally a matter of life and death. Demining areas with such diverse geographies and climates is a difficult, exhausting, and time-consuming task. We need highly skilled and effective forces with specialist training to rid the world of unexploded ordnance and make it safe for civilians again. It goes without saying that these forces also need advanced tools and a huge budget. Halime was only 10 years old when, on her way back from school, she stepped on a mine carried to her village by the river. Hatun was 7 when she stepped on a mine while playing with her friends in the village. That area had previously been demined. Fardin was busy working in the field when he came across a plastic object. He picked it up out of curiosity, and the mine exploded in his hands. both his hands were amputated at the wrists. He completely lost one of his eyes, and the other eye can only barely make out the light. The victims of mine explosions and their families need immediate medical attention and financial support after the accident. They won't be able to carry on living normal lives anymore. For instance, a child who has lost a limb needs new prosthetics as he or she grows older, as well as constant physiotherapy and psychotherapy. Halime is now receiving medical care and financial support, but nothing can make her forget the pain she has suffered. Khatun is determined to do what she loves, despite her physical and mental scars. Fardin is going through the different steps of his treatment and is glad that his remaining eye is getting better after several operations. Landmines have been much crueler to the children of the Dehgorji village, though. The children discovered a Volmara bouncing fragmentation mine while out playing. This type of mine detonates in two stages. The first explosion launches it about 40 to 50 centimeters off the ground, where the main charge detonates, projecting more than 1,000 fragmentations in all directions, and killing or wounding everyone within an effectable radius. 5 children were killed. For a child, the difference between knowing how to act when faced with a landmine or unexploded ordnance and not knowing how dangerous they are is literally life or death. Children are the age group most hurt by these munitions. That's why the more the number of civilians educated about them, the less the casualties. Demining operations must be supplemented with civilian education, which has a real effect on reducing deaths and the loss of limbs. The geographical dispersion, the varying lifestyles and ages of the people at risk from landmines, makes educating them a big challenge. Not to mention that most of these people are villagers, shepherds, and nomads. Some of them are even travelers who just pass through these areas. The places those people need to be educated have a larger combined area than the regions that require demining. The educational materials and methods need to be adapted to the different ages and different sections of society. The Mine Action Center is responsible for the policy making, planning, and assessing the effectiveness of the education. Accordingly, the center focuses on prioritizing the different regions in need of education and producing and adapting the educational materials to match the type of threat and the target audience. The educational materials are produced in the form of documentaries, stories, or even animations in different local languages and provided to educators. Brochures, books, and pictures are also used in some areas. Offering educational programs in addition to demining operations has resulted in an estimated 90% drop in the number of casualties compared to previous years. The demining process in Iran has one major difference with the rest of the world, and that is the limitations caused by the unjust, politically motivated sanctions which prevent any country or international organization from collaborating with the Islamic Republic. A look at the statistics reveals that Iran hasn't received any financial aid for its humanitarian demining activities. In addition, Iran isn't given access to advanced equipment. It is even banned from using the IMSMA, the Information Management System for Mine Action, which registers information regarding the detection and clearance of mines. Put simply, Iran is barred from receiving any equipment or financial and scientific aid. Why? Because Iran is sanctioned, and therefore its demining operations are also sanctioned. After the war, the lands all along the border was unusable due to contamination. Every day, life and business in these areas were facing total destruction. More important, however, was the damage done to the public's mental sense of security. This map shows the regions of Iran's five border provinces contaminated with landmines and unexploded ordnance after the end of the war. Despite all the sanctions and limitations, published statistics reveal that the Islamic Republic of Iran Mine Action Center boasts the highest number of discovered mines in 2019.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is no stranger to the work we do, and Excellency, your country has consistently supported the efforts of the General Assembly in the elaboration of resolutions on assistance in mine action and other very important disarmament resolutions.
They might have been able to impose great limitations on Iran's humanitarian demining activities through their sanctions, but nevertheless, the Islamic Republic of Iran Mine Action Center still outperforms all other countries when it comes to mine clearance, thanks to its achievements and wealth of experience.
And I think also the mix of the countries and the participants in this particular roundtable was just excellent. I mean, I must congratulate the Iranian, the IRMAC, for having done such a good choice. I can also say that, you know, we all know that Iran plays a very particular and important role in this region. And it is clear that in the future there is a very good prospect to have a stronger interaction for all of you with the Islamic Republic of Iran with regard to humanitarian demining and maybe also in other aspects.
Opening the doors of the Iranian Mine Action Center, which is an institution under the Ministry of Defense, and which shows also the openness and readiness of the Islamic Republic of Iran to share and learn from partner countries. So these would be my improvised last words today.
The Islamic Republic of Iran Mine Action Center's International Education, a center for the exchange of experience, support of research and scientific activities, and improving the knowledge and skill of mine clearance squads. This education center represents the peak of the Mine Action Center's abilities and the essence of its scientific advancements. Research projects regarding novel ways of clearing mines are always of high priority at this center. This complex isn't restricted to just Iranian squads, and students from other countries are allowed to attend the programs held here. This center strives to expand humanitarian demining efforts and help improve the mine clearance capabilities of other countries. Iran's increasing knowledge of demining has led international institutions and other countries struggling with the clearance of unexploded munitions to request to collaborate with Iran. Khuzestan Province, Darkhobain. This region had been underwater for the past years, and as the water subsided, an unbelievable scene began to emerge. Thousands of unexploded ordnance, left over from the war, were sticking out of the ground, which couldn't be seen before. Although the area had been previously cleared, this deadly munition field had expanded the contaminated area once again. Iranian lands contaminated with mines and unexploded ordnance were cut from 4,200,000 hectares to around 100,000 hectares through 30 years of demining operations. Clearing the remaining area, however, is proving more difficult than all the previous areas that had been cleared combined. This is because these lands have very special characteristics. At least 50,000 hectares are flooded, making the job similar to finding a needle in a haystack. These regions need to be demined regardless, because they can contaminate nearby safe zones and are a threat to the lives of those living there. The more advanced the weapons became, the more people died after the wars ended. As soon as one war ended, another would begin, and so the weapons never stopped firing. One thing all those wars had in common was the unexploded munitions and mines they left behind. Very little attention is paid to the deaths caused by unexploded munitions, because they happen after the war is over, and because everybody thinks the war is not going to claim any more lives now that it's over.
Muscle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly, I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly, she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javidar, guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the studio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, let's talk about some of the jurisprudential rules of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And let me begin this episode with this question, Sheikh. You know, somebody asked, I am a computer programmer, and various orders or projects are offered to me. Can I pass them on to somebody else actually to do it and take part, you know, a part of the price or a portion of, for example, the wage that is offered to me for myself as the person who introduced the work?
Well, it depends on the contract maybe signed by the two parties.
Yes.
If it is stipulated or it is understood from the context that, for example, you have to do the work yourself, it is not permissible to relegate the task to someone else or to let someone else do it,
mm-hmm.
because that person might actually not agree to what you might be willing to do. Of course, everybody might be willing to give the task to someone else to do it, in order for him to be able to earn some money, an extra amount of money. But maybe if the quality of the task done by the other party or by the third party is not as good as the task done by the person himself, then in such a case, the person who entrusted his task to you may not be consenting to it. Therefore, you can only entrust it to someone else for a greater or maybe equal price if that individual is consenting to it, if he is willing, if he is happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if you do something of the work, then you can entrust it to someone else for a lower price.
Mm-hmm.
It all depends on the agreement initially.
Yes.
On the initial agreement, in fact.
If it has been stipulated, for example, in the contract, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, thank you. Well, a person wants to take money from others to invest in his work in, let's say, advertising or service industry, and give him some profit. Which Sharia transaction or legal transaction, in fact, serves this purpose?
Well, he can conclude a contract to be their attorney in such a way that the owners of the capital give him power of attorney to carry out the economic activity with their money, to give them a certain amount according to the agreement of the obtained profit monthly or at the end of the contract, and to take the rest for himself as fee for doing the job. So I use the term attorney, but of course there are some scholars, some translators who have used the term agent. It doesn't make any difference. So the agent can do as agreed, as for example, those who has vested him with the authority or given him the authority to carry out the transaction. So as an agent, he can take out his fees and give the rest as stipulated in the contract to the to those who earn the investment or the capital.
I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on iranradio.ir with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program. Stay with us.
Followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Tawid, in an on-credit transaction, if the buyer, any individual, says that I will pay for example, that service or product when I get the money, is such a transaction correct?
Well, for an on-credit transaction to be valid, it's necessary to specify the time of the payment or the time for the payment. Therefore, the said transaction is not valid because the time for payment is ambiguous. It's not clarified in the transaction or in the contract as to when and what time, what day or what date he's going to repay the amount. So since it is unclear, according to His Eminence, the transaction is invalid. But if the seller consents to the customer's possession of the sold goods, the sold items, despite the fact that the transaction is invalid, mm-hmm. according to His Eminence, there is no problem with the customer using that good or that property that he has taken possession of. Okay, mm-hmm. despite the contract being invalid, because of the fact that the time for the payment is unknown, he can still use the goods that he has taken home.
Mm-hmm. But is the transaction valid because he doesn't pay at the time of buying or purchase?
Yeah, he does the transaction because if it is pay, if the time is fixed, it is correct, it's valid. Uh-huh. But because the time for payment is not known and it's left, okay, he says such as, for example, as you rightly mentioned, he says that, okay, I'm going to get that to repay you the money whenever I get the money, mm. okay? It's not known when he's going to get the money.
Exactly.
So that's why His Eminence says that the transaction is invalid, but still he can use the property because the owner is consenting to it. Mm-hmm. As long as the owner of the property consents to his using the property, there is no objection.
So the element of consent is necessary?
Is necessary, yes.
I see. Okay, another question let me ask actually in this portion of the program Islamic Laws. Is it necessary to observe hijab in a mustahab or recommended prayers, such as night prayers? And if it is not observed, is the prayer itself valid?
Well, sometimes we use the term prayer to refer to supplication, dua, okay, mm-hmm. or reciting the Quran. Of course, there's no problem in reciting the Quran or engaging in a dua, for example, reciting dua kumal, dua tawassul, or any other dua, without any proper hijab, as long as you are in your home, staying alone without any mahram being around, so you can recite those supplications without observing proper hijab. Though observing hijab is highly recommended, even when there is no one and you are engaging in dua and supplications. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to obligatory or mustahab prayer, it does not make any difference as to whether the prayer that you are offering is mustahab or obligatory. For example, you are reciting Salat Ghufayla or Namaz Tahajjud, the midnight prayer, and it makes no difference whether it's midnight prayer or it's the Fajr prayer. You have to, as a woman, a woman must observe proper hijab. She should cover her hair and neck and, of course, all parts of her body except her face and feet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When there is no non-mahram, of course, she does not have to cover her feet. But if there is a non-mahram
but
around,
this rule doesn't apply to supplication, does it?
No, it's not applicable to supplication.
I see.
Yes.
Only prayers.
Only prayers.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on iranradio.ir. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyina Muhammadin wa Ali.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on iranradio.ir with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, somebody asked us, my daughter has just reached bulugh or physical maturity, but cannot fast or is not able to fast. What is her legal or Sharia duty?
Well, when we talk about bulugh, or you use the term physical maturity, I don't think it's the right term to use physical, because sometimes a girl might be very, for example, fat and very, you know, big, but she's not attained puberty according to Islamic Sharia, because Islamic Sharia measures puberty according to the year she has lived through. For example, if a year, if a girl has completed 9 years of her age, lunar years of her age, then she is considered to be mature and adult according to Islamic Sharia. Maybe she's not physically fit for fasting, for observing fast, or in engaging in any kind of ibadah or acts of worship, which are.
You mean she has reached mature puberty, but not reached maturity?
I think
is this what you mean?
The thing is that we are using the term maturity and puberty interchangeably.
Uh-huh.
And that's very confusing for our audience.
Yes.
We must use one of those words. Sometimes I use the word puberty, sometimes maturity, but maturity has something to do with the mind rather than the body. So puberty, I use the term puberty or adulthood.
Uh-huh.
The Arabic word for adulthood is bulugh, okay?
Right.
So if a girl attains puberty, the Sharia means actually that she has completed 9 lunar years, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and many other scholars who consider completion of 9 lunar years as a sign of puberty or a sign of adulthood. So when a girl has completed 9 lunar years, she must start fasting, she must start praying, she must start doing any other religious duties. So as long as she can do it, she can. It's not, for example, harmful to her health, it's not extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So because God, la yukallifullah nafsan illa wus'aha, God does not obligate someone beyond her capacity, beyond their ability, and that could be physical ability, okay? So if fasting is harmful to someone's health, it's not permissible to fast, okay? If fasting is unbearable, unbearable means that it is extremely difficult for us.
Or harmful to her body, for example.
Then it's not permissible to fast.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, my dear listeners, for joining us, your own program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, and the rest of the crew. We wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Credo News Roundup, your one-stop shop for all news West Asia. My name is Esteban Carrillo. I am the news editor for the Credo. And as usual, I'm joined by my colleagues, content creator and writer for the Credo, Karim Shami, and content creator and social media manager for the Credo, Sima Itayim. Just to get into Yemen a bit, because I don't want us to go too long into it, but Yemen has become the target of the U.S. War, of these very intense attacks that have been happening. We talked about it last week. again, we know this is not going to resolve at the end of a gun, but there's also Iraq, right? Like, Iraq is also been starting to get pressure to dismantle the PMU and all of these factions from Israel. But as Karim often puts it, right, Iraq is just going to do whatever is told. And then at the end of the list is Iran, right, with the letter from Trump to Khamenei and the threats that are continuing. We heard a few months ago that Israel was planning to launch attacks on Iran with the U.S. help in 6 months, right? They said by the fall, right? So, again, none of us here have a crystal ball, sadly, but the way things are going, it does seem like this has kind of become the status quo, right? And I think one of the places that you can see it clearly clearest is in Lebanon, where, again, the Israeli occupation army has continued to launch attacks, killing several people just over this weekend in the south, in the east of Lebanon, threatening to expand attacks on Beirut again, obviously threatening the airport, obviously threatening the usual things that they do, civilians, and the United States standing right behind them, saying, you know, we are willing to give you a freedom of action, at the same time talking with the Lebanese leaders who are scrambling to put a stop to this in any way. But I feel like in Gaza, like in the West Bank, you as an Arab can do what you want to protect your people. But at the end of the day, if the biggest, the most powerful empire in history is standing behind this genocidal, suicidal nation that is on a warpath, I don't think there's much that you can do, right? And I feel very concerned about what may come next for Lebanon, because now we're hearing, you know, over the weekend there was a rocket attack that was launched from Lebanese soil into the Metula settlement in Israel. And this was used to expand the air campaign. And then we were hearing some reports say that Israel may be trying to essentially do a false flag, right? To justify, dropping bombs in Beirut and just expanding their aggression. Because at the end of the day, they want us to roll over. They want everyone to roll over to tap out and just to say, okay, we will normalize with you. But at what cost, right? And who is willing to do it? What do you guys think about what's happening in Lebanon, about this escalation? Because it's been coming from Syria as well, not just from Israel.
Karim, before I let you go, I mean, it's a one-sided war. Lebanon's under constant attack. We saw attacks yesterday in the south that killed, a citizen. And by the way, guys, just pointing it out there, if someone is in Hezbollah but is not in combat, then it is a civilian. So I just wanted to make that clear to anybody.
These are the rules of war, right? These are
the rules of war. Yeah, to anyone who was confused about that. So, you know, your stuff doesn't fly with me. Anyway, so we had like very, very, very brutal strikes. They started before this thing happened, where on Saturday, 5 primitive rockets were launched at the Israeli settlement of Umtalle or Metula. And in response, Israel unleashed a heavy wave of airstrikes, like very heavy, on both southern and eastern Lebanon. And Hezbollah, which typically claims responsibility for its operations, denied involvement in this rocket fire. I mean, if you see the photo of the rocket launches, you'll know it's not Hezbollah. I mean, I think it's just agents working for Israel trying to give them excuse. But they don't need an excuse. Again, they don't need an excuse, so not so sure. Israel claimed to have targeted, of course, Hezbollah infrastructure, including command centers and rocket sites, and the death toll is at least 8 people. And of course, they're saying they're doing this to protect their civilians. And of course, the Lebanese state has remained completely silent. You know, no condemnation.
Really?
Yeah, no statements. Oh, you're being sarcastic.
Breaking news.
No, just silence. Silence, you know. For the South, it's like, of course, once again, all these decades later, nothing has changed. The South is treated as though it's not a part of Lebanon. It's totally neglected. And to make matters worse, since the truce was signed in November, you know, Israel's reported it has violated the ceasefire not 1,000 times, not 1,500 times, but thousands of times. Mm-hmm. And, of course, continues to occupy these new 5 strict positions. And Hezbollah has intentionally taken a step back. Hezbollah is not in a great place, is it? Heavily targeted, not given a moment to breathe. Even its newer leaders that have been recently appointed are being targeted one by one. Anyway, Hezbollah has given the Lebanese government and army space to act, standing behind the army and allowing the state a chance to rise to the occasion. But let's be honest, that's leading nowhere. So we are under a one-sided war. And again, it's like, oh, thank you to the government for working to make sure that Beirut won't be hit, because the south isn't a part of Lebanon. We should only worry if Beirut is hit, right? And anyway, this is Lebanon without the resistance, you know? It's a Lebanon that plays into Israel's hands and that seeks complete inaction over justice at any price and, of course, bends to external pressure. Can't even muster up a statement to condemn strikes on its own land.
Currently in Lebanon and previously, and before even the assassination of Sayyid Hassan, Lebanon is either black or white. There is no gray part. You are either with Israel or against Israel. That's it. Previously, the majority or the power that Hezbollah possessed prevented the government to take some decisions such as normalizing, and that's it. And they didn't use their power internally at all. Currently, the power has shifted, but the people are still the same. And the people that believe in retaliation and resistance are the same percentage as before the assassination of Sayyid Hassan. But what happened now is that the power inside the government shifted, and now the people that are against Hezbollah are acting as if they were the people who fought Hezbollah, and they are taking decisions against Hezbollah as if they are the ones who won. Just to let you know how much the Israelis they are. They are not even Zionist. Zionist is like a very beautiful word for them. They are Israelis. There's no difference. I think they will push for everything. And even the Israelis will tell them, khalas, stop, as what happened last month. If you know Arabic and you're following the Lebanese journalists that are aligned with Israel and Saudi Arabia, you will see that they were pushing for normalizations in the media with Israel, and they are preparing the masses. They are saying, if not this week, next week. And now when you go to the streets in Lebanon, you will see, I think the normalization is before the summer. The new school year, you will have normalization.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny part is that the Israelis went out and said, no, we don't want normalization now because we have parts of your country. We don't want to make a new borders with Lebanon. We are happy as we are.
Yes.
And after that, the journalists and the people that go to the TVs, they stopped talking about the normalization because Israel told them, no, that's not now,
babies. That's not what we want.
Talk about something else. So, in short, there's either black or white in Lebanon. You're either with or against Israel. If you're with Israel, currently you are pushing the narrative of the United States and the Israelis and the Saudi Arabians that everything is blamed on Hezbollah.
Indeed, Lebanon really is, between a rock and a hard place. It's a country.
By the way,
that
there's a drone. There's a drone now. It came back. It's hovering above Beirut. It's really loud.
That's been the status quo.
For the Lebanese army?
No, it's an Israeli drone.
We saw the Lebanese Air Force a few days ago when they bombed Syria with their World War II planes. Sadly, that is, again, the status quo, that nations need to heal, nations need to be bowed, against the occupier, against the genociders, right?
By the way, guys, this is Hossam. He was only 22 years old. You know him. This is the Al Jazeera correspondent, Hossam Shabbat. So, yeah, he was born in 2001. He's the second journalist they killed today, like within a span of less than 3 hours.
It's been 208 journalists killed. 208
maybe 209 now even.
We saw, it was one of the NGOs that track attacks against journalists that said a few months ago that the biggest cause of death for journalists in war zones for the past year and a half has been the Israeli army. So again, this is kind of what has become normal, right? And just to finish my thought about what I want to say about Lebanon is that Lebanon needs billions to reconstruct for the damage that it has already incurred by the attacks, by the Israeli attacks, by the U.S.-backed war. This is money that is being offered, right, by the IMF, by the World Bank, by the Saudis, by the Qataris, etc., by the U.S., I guess. And everything is conditioned. Everything is conditioned and more likely than not conditioned on normalization. And as you guys said, more likely as Ghassan Kanafani said, right, the neck does not negotiate against the sword. Sadly, that is exactly the position that Lebanon finds itself in. But we will continue to discuss this as the weeks go on. I want us to move to Turkey, a nation we don't often discuss on its own, but that has warranted discussion over recent days, because a huge protest broke out in across Turkey, several cities, following the arrest of Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu. Over 1,100 people arrested as of this recording, including 9 journalists. İmamoğlu, a prominent figure in Turkish politics, and Recep Tayyip Erdogan's main rival, who could be considered, possibly the next president of Turkey in the upcoming elections in 2028, by the way. So Erdogan really acting way ahead of time to jail his competitors. Turkey at this point finds itself in a very interesting position following the fall of Syria, right? And they seem to have consolidated a lot of power, a lot of importance, in particular, as NATO members. They are in a way the keepers of Syria, no? Of the ISIS government that is currently governing there. And also an interesting report that I want to mention is that last week the EU, a report comes out last week saying that the EU is apparently reconsidering allowing Turkey into the Union, right? To allow Turkey to become a full EU member. Why? Because they need a new arms dealer. They need to start buying weapons from someone else, because now we know that Europe is on a desperate rush to start arming themselves for their, inevitable war with Russia, now that the United States has essentially left them, standing out in the cold on their own. So all of a sudden, being friendly with Turkey seems to be the correct move for them. So, I just want to give that context to why, right, we are seeing essentially the breakdown of any, democratic pretenses that may have existed in the former Ottoman Empire, to now become more of only Erdogan can be in power, only Erdogan can protect our interests, only Erdogan can move forward. So, what have you guys heard? What have you guys seen about what's been happening in Turkey?
Hello. First, to be honest, I'm not that professional in Turkey issues, internal issues. But of course, we all saw what happened. We saw that the mayor of Istanbul. Mm-hmm. Was detained, and yesterday he was jailed. Yani they jailed him on
officially, yes.
Yeah, officially jailed, and we know that the mayor in Istanbul, he was elected by the people of Istanbul, and this is a big difference. Yeah, in our region or in Lebanon, for instance, usually mayors are appointed, but he was elected. That means that the people elected him and they love him for the city. That's why we saw many people went to the streets. But the background story, I read many things, and some people say that because he was. He had his education in Cyprus, and it was revoked. And with him, 106 people were also their education was revoked. But the point is that, as you said, it's of course it's political. Yani if he was from his party, this won't happen, and we all know this.
If he was from the AKP, right? That's Erdogan's party.
So, and the point is that I don't know his ideology. Yani maybe both him and Erdogan is good for the country or bad for the Turkey, but we discuss here what's good and bad for the region. I don't know the stance of the mayor of Istanbul.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about him? Do you know? Yani he's good with Iran. He's good with the United States. He's good with Israel. Yeah, we have to know this before.
I imagine he's not, a very pro-resistant character.
I don't know, but what's happening here now currently in Turkey, as I see it, as a person who's not too much into Turkey, this either will make Erdogan the ultimate leader for maybe at least one decade or two decades to come, or it will weaken him. We have to wait and see. And we know that Turkey now has foots in many places, in Libya. If Erdogan is weakened, because this is Erdogan's policy, I don't think this is the policy of Turkey. We have to differentiate this. And of course, Syria will be weakened if he's weakened. Or if he gets the full power, then he can do whatever he wants in Syria, in Qatar, in Libya. We have to wait and see.
Just to give a bit of a rundown in case there's anyone watching who has no idea. So he was, formally arrested yesterday on corruption charges, but also was previously detained for not only corruption, but terror links, to the PKK. So the court accuses him of everything from embezzlement to rigging bids to to unlawful data collection. And he called this like unimaginable slander, and he put out all these things on social media like, I will never bow down and we will get through this and whatever. So initially, before yesterday, he was like formally arrested yesterday. So he was detained in a dawn raid earlier this week, just as his party, which is the CHP, began endorsing him as a 2028 presidential candidate. So, you know, the timing, you know, says a lot. And so, as you guys mentioned,